radio, online and on digital.
The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
My co-host this morning is the one and only Rachel Berger. Good morning.
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here with you in the studio.
Rachel, it's lovely to see you. Comedian, broadcaster, novelist, economist, agitator and television entertainer.
Obsessive, compulsive, clean person.
What are you actually doing at the moment?
Well, I'm about to do some stand-up shows in a few weeks at the Butterfly Club, which is a tiny place in Melbourne, 50 City, which is very unique, but it's a great place to do new material.
How delightful that would be. Are you testing something?
Look, I think as a comedian you're always testing material. I've been doing this for 25 years. You never stop testing because you're always going to have new material and there's always a lot happening. And I think also, I mean, 25 years is a long time. So my lens on the world is changing, you know, as I get older and probably crankier. I was listening on the way in, you know, sadly all the leading newspapers doing, you know, stories about the situation with people not having enough food. And I find that difficult to hear when I...
In a city like this.
Absolutely, when people are so, you know, crazy about it. And have become... I grew up in a deli. I always say to people, I'm a food slut. Mm. I eat around anywhere, anytime. So, but I'm not a snob with food.
Mm.
And so I find it really, in particularly given those circumstances, that you will go to a market, Paran or Victoria, and there's you know, some person screeching because they want a particular kind of parmesan. They can't have the one.
We've become almost fetishized about food. And, particularly in a city like Melbourne and with shows like, obviously, MasterChef, and where you've got, you know, 11-year-olds talking about different kinds of truffles and
it's a fetishist, but more than that, it's about not really understanding that it's not a social status. Food is not about social status. Not if you want to buy, you know, a regular parmesan at the supermarket, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have a better palate or that you're a better person or that you know more than buying a whatever, you know, whatever the expense.
It goes both ways, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I remember when risotto first became popular and, you know, people paying, you know, $30 or something for a bowl of risotto and just thinking, you know, this is peasant food. This is rice.
This
is what people made, you know, when they had to put a meal together. And
I remember being at school in the western suburbs and taking these lunches that were vile, longing for little white sandwiches with hundreds and thousands on a little fairy bread. At the same time, I would have, you know, 500 gram of rye bread with a piece of Edam cheese and pickle. And I stank. Everybody at school thought I stank because I just food. All I wanted was little four squares in a little Tupperware container, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden now, people are saying to me, oh, how can you possibly eat that bread? It's just white bread. Mm. Well, I can eat white bread, I can eat rye bread, I can eat whatever bread. But there's such a lot of everything, and you can have it. And little screaming children because they want a baby chino. I just go to the market and get cranky and yell at them. That's what I do. But yeah, it's very hard, or, you know, people just not understanding the process between wanting something and having it. That's become, it's so minimal now. Mm. You can have bigger hair, you can have new breasts, you can have a different body, you can have whatever food you want. You just pay for it and you get it. Mm. And so there's no sense of process.
But not everybody's able to partake in that, of course.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly, exactly. So this is a sort of material that I like to talk about, and all I do is just put another lens on it and make it funny so people don't go away
upset. Fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
But that's always been the kind of the grist for the stuff that I talk about, very much about life, because I'm out there all the time.
That's why you're an agitator as well.
I'm an agitator, yes. Mm. Somebody said I tilted at shibboleths once. It took me 6 months to find out what that meant. But I think it's, you know, I also started stand-up when I was 32. Not, I wasn't 18 or 20. So, you know, I came in with a whole lot of opinions and ideas, not all of them right. But I don't.
That's probably a great age to start
stand-up. For women, it happens a lot.
Right,
Patty had a divorce or whatever, or, you know, just got, not that the younger women don't have something to say, they do, and there's more of them now anyway.
Well, you get to store up a lot of material too that you can then have a very fresh take.
Because I think the basis of any good comedian is that you are congruent with what you're saying.
Mm.
You can't talk about something for the sake of talking about it. Otherwise, the audience sniffs it like a dog when you're scared. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So if you're talking from a place where it's completely your experience and they know it's your experience, you're not embellishing it just to make it funny, but to make it accessible. Because I think that's what all comedians do. It is no mythical special skill other than turning a lens and saying, okay, you're looking at it one way, let me turn it around for you and give it to you another way.
Maybe politicians should be doing a bit of stand-up comedy.
Do you know how many times I've advocated that? I have advocated that.
Because that's what seems to have been lost, is this connection to people, that where people hear a politician speak and think, I agree with that, you know, I feel that, or just to be moved, that, you know, perhaps a bit of stand-up comedy would
shake
it up a bit.
Oh, absolutely, because they've all been trained in media training. They've all, you know, they're doing the spin, and we all know it. This is why it's so ridiculous. We all know this spinning. Why not just tell it how it is? And what's interesting is that sometimes, although I may not agree with a politician, I'm always really thrilled when I know someone at least is saying what they believe and what they're passionate about, even if I don't agree with them. It seems that language itself has been completely fabricated into a way of communicating little blocks of ideas, but we leave our own personal self behind, if that makes sense. So you're not even allowed to say, but you know, all the weasel words come from that. You know, everything's a challenge. Yep. No, it's hard. Not a challenge. It's actually hard. Or when people, my favourite one at the moment is inclusivity. You always see it on public service documents where people are actually not included. You know, it's a word, they mean nothing.
Yeah. No, that one's truly bizarre.
Inclusivity.
Moving forward, going forward.
The whole lot of them. There's a whole lot of them. And to do with food as well. Because this is one of my favourite topics. Everything is branded. So we're being delivered everything in a brand, whether it's weight loss, whether it's beauty, whether it's food, whether it's relationship. You know, you open a magazine, there's always 20 ways to keep your relationship alive. It's always never one or two. I always think one would be good.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Just one. But this, it's like everything is, all right, so out of these 20 things, there's two that I have or whatever. And, you know, they're always really stupid things.
Well, maybe, you know, we've talked about them already, Rachel. You speak from the heart.
Maybe.
And share a good meal together.
That's what, look.
A nice piece of bread and a nice piece of cheese.
Anywhere, I've done a lot of travelling, and wherever I go, food is the glue in any culture. You don't need to speak when you hand somebody an apple or a piece of fruit or, you know, I remember being in the Sinai Desert and sitting down with Bedouins, and we didn't speak the same language, and one of the guys just took an apple, cut it up beautifully into quarters with a small knife and just put it out in his hand.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
Yep.
You don't need to do anything else. So, yes, so I'm into, you know, some cornflakes, some porridge, you know. No wagyu beef.
I think, Rachel, I'm into what you're into.
Yes, just simple, straightforward. But then people think you're a provocateur.
An agitator. I think we better, we're going to be talking to somebody in a few moments, Caroline Burke, who is the author of a new biography of Edith Piaf.
I'm so excited.
Yeah, talking about somebody who started on the with probably not quite proper nutrition. We'll ask Caroline Burke about that. But the author of No Regrets, a new biography of Edith Piaf. And also we'll be joined this morning by Nadine Garner, who's an actress everybody, I'm sure, will remember, whether it's from the Henderson Kids or the list is too long. But she's made her debut as a director.
Yes.
And I can't wait to talk to Nadine Garner.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Caroline Burke is the author of a new biography on Edith Piaf, The Little Sparrow, and my co-host Rachel Berger and I are delighted.
Very excited.
Yeah. Tell us about how this book came about, because, of course, there are many biographies, many stories.
Right.
And films now too, about Edith Piaf. So why did you write this one?
Oh, first of all, I've lived with her music since I was a teenager. When I was learning French in Paris, I first heard her, and she just knocked me over with the power of her voice, the passion and the beauty of the songs, some of which we've just been talking about, like La Foule, the crowd. But to my great surprise, my French teacher at the Sorbonne said one day, if you want to hear really good French, really good diction and pronunciation, listen to Edith Piaf. So I began singing along with her, thinking, ah, this is how I'll learn French. That was the start of it all.
It's a beautiful way to learn, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
And this was in the later part, of course, of Edith Piaf's career, and I think in 1959,
Correct.
During her so-called suicide tour.
Yes, she was very, very ill and at the same time so determined to go on singing because that was the thing that gave her joy and was really the center of her life. So she went on this tour despite the doctor's orders to cancel, and towards the end of it, she did collapse on stage and had to go back into hospital.
So your interest came through her music. And of course, this biography really focuses on the music as well. And in an attempt to get away, as you write, from that rags to riches cliche that is the focus of so much Piaf literature.
Some previous Piaf books did go about it with that rags to riches and oh poor suffering waif destructive sparrow kind of idea, and there's so much more to her.
There is a lot more to her, and I just want to quote Helen Keller because she's a hero of mine, and then in reference to Piaf, because I've always sort of thought of them in a similar kind of vein. Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. Security is mostly superstition. It does not exist in nature. That was what Helen Keller said. Now, I always have thought of Piaf, and what comes out of this book is that passion, that sort of fearlessness to continue going on in the resilience, which I think is very appropriate in these times that we live anyway. But people have always spoken more of her, which is not uncommon with women, to speak of them as victims, whereas she was incredibly strong and potent.
That's right. I wanted to turn that whole thing around, and I'm so glad you read the Helen Keller quote because it's perfectly
appropriate. It's wonderful, isn't it?
Mm. Part of my motivation was to show Piaf's resilience and fearlessness, to use your word, and to underline her great bravery, both personal and political, for instance, during World War II, which wasn't so well known.
And also that security is a superstition. See, that's important for me as well, because she understood, coming from her background, that security is a superstition. There is no such thing ever, whether it's in a career, in life, she'd gone through a war. To believe that we set something up and it stays like that it doesn't make sense. And I think it's what has always come through to me in her voice is not just the technique, but there is this sense of absolute, I will get through this, I will do this, whether it's about love, whether it's about loss, whether it's about war and conflict. You know, it's so powerful. It's visceral. And I think that's why she's always been so popular.
Yes, it's absolutely visceral. She gets right inside you. And Maurice Chevalier's first comment on hearing her sing was so appropriate. He said, "That kid Sparrow tears out your guts." You know, you do feel it at that level.
Yeah.
She said when applying for the French Songwriters Union, "My song is my life," which I just found almost sort of heartbreakingly beautiful as well. What do you think she meant by it?
She had become an articulate, conscious person through music, through her songs, first as a little girl, then going off on her own to sing in the streets of Paris. She had literally made her way from day to day, earning her keep by singing, and gradually she'd come into the sense that she could write her own songs. She wrote nearly 100, which is not well known, and she learned from some of the best songwriters who were her lovers and friends. Mm. And so music really was what gave her life and allowed her to become this brave person who would keep on going. Also, I should say, the tremendous bond with the audience. You know, the ordinary people who loved her, who adored her, she felt that support. And for the rest of her life, maintained in a very, very conscious way her bond with her audience.
Well, this is what we were saying earlier about being congruent. you know, when you're congruent with what you're saying and what you're singing, people feel that, whether on stage, in a crowd, whatever. But I want to ask you, you know, if our work is always a statement of where we are in our life.
Yes.
And it's always a journey personally for ourselves, not just the work itself, but the process.
Mm.
So for you, what manifests for you in researching Piaf and then writing the book? I mean, as you said, she gets into you. So she must have gotten into you.
She did.
So did you feel a difference at the end of this process?
I felt several things. One is her great generosity. I think that she transmitted that to me somehow, or her life did. She was so generous to her entourage, to all the younger singers, to everyone who came close to her. And I think I literally learned the importance of giving all you've got. And, you know, I perhaps can't go to the extent that Piaf did, but that was one great gift from her. I also, I think, became braver. As you said earlier, she was a fearless person, and I think she inspired that in me. I've not always been the most courageous person, but I'm literally able to go out and try almost anything now. And that comes to me from Piaf, too.
How did you source new material on Piaf?
I was very lucky. I knew that a very large cache of correspondence that had never been seen before, at least in English, and very little in French, had suddenly been made available, or rather recently made available in France. And I was able to obtain permission first to read all those letters between Piaf and her mentor.
Amazing.
And then, because the Piaf estate approved of my project, I was able to also translate them, draw on them, and quote them a lot in the book to give what I feel is her inner voice and to show her development from ragamuffin to, a woman who is actively in charge of her own career, writing her songs, directing her performances and choosing her repertoire in function of who she is.
It must be such an extraordinary thing to write a biography of somebody who already is incredibly famous, to kind of live with them for as long as it takes for the book to be done, and then having to let it go, I suppose, once the work is completed. What's that like?
It's very interesting. I'm in the middle of it now. It's not so much a letting go as bringing Piaf to people around the world, really, now that I'm able to be in Australia again. It's marvelous. I feel as if I'm returning her to all her fans and hopefully letting them know much more about her than was available in the past. So while it's a bit painful, I don't think she'll ever be absent from my life. She'll always be with me.
She's very dear to you, isn't she?
Oh, completely dear to me, although I know she could be quite a tyrant and difficult at times, but she's very dear to me. That's what happens in writing a life.
But also she was dear. I mean, when you read about her funeral and how many, 40,000 people walking. I mean, at that time, that's incredible. She was dear to everyone. And I was listening, in preparation, I sat there last night listening to a whole lot of, you know, recordings and YouTube clips and couldn't stop. You know, sort of 2 o'clock in the morning, listening to me. And everyone, you think, this is amazing.
This
connection, it's so powerful.
She was perhaps unique that way.
Yeah.
I was in a little French bistro on, I think it was Saturday night, and we asked if they could put some Piaf on because I was talking about reading this book, and they did. It was lovely.
Oh, how gorgeous.
It was beautiful.
How appropriate to be eating French food and listening to
Well,
Piaf.
I do my research.
With my eating.
I do it that way too.
I wish I'd thought of that.
I have to say, I drank too much red wine while writing this book.
Oh, really? Yes, that's the way it manifested for you by drinking. What a good
Well, and in fact, of course, Edith Piaf is so well known for her overindulgence.
Yes.
Did you find anything new about that part of her life?
I did. I found out that, in fact, a lot of our stereotypes and assumptions misrepresent the situation. she took a lot of drugs that were prescribed by her doctors because she was in great pain, starting with her chronic arthritis, which was crippling. So she took the prescription drugs available at the time in the late 40s and 50s when no one was paying attention to the effects of, you know, usage of multiple different kinds of medicines. And that's what happened to her. She wasn't doing it because she was, quote-unquote, a drug addict. It was rather to manage her pain. And that combined with the wine, of course, wasn't such a great idea. But she also underwent 3 detox cures. She tried very hard to help herself do without some of these medicines. And towards the end of her life, she was doing much better with that. But by then, the damage to her liver was so extensive that she succumbed to a number of episodes that were almost fatal.
Mm. That's why it's so good with a biography, when you find that sort of material and you can clarify for people, you know, the real, because Lenny Bruce was the same, that comedian, people said he just was this massive drug addict. He actually had a lot of prescription drugs, which then led to him, you know, then doing other drugs and the mix of them. And it clarifies where they were in their head. And to think that they were in that space physically and psychically and still to produce the work that they did.
That's it.
That's what always amazes me.
She always said that she had to do this to carry on, to keep on singing, and since singing was the love of her life. But I wonder why it is that we want to think the worst of people. No, that's very puzzling to me. Why do we want to believe...
Do you think it's the worst, or do you think that there's just a sort of hunger to make people...
That
they're not interesting enough. Of course they are, you know,
but
we need to hyperbolize everything. We need to make everything, you know, have a sort of steroid-enhanced
version.
That
could be. That could be.
Yeah, she was fabulous, but she was also broken, that she was unlucky in love, but that she was a great singer. You know, they can't just be, nor that she, like all of us, was broken in parts and fine others.
It's strange that we come back to those clichés, especially for artists, for performing artists and other, you know, they're creative, but they've got to suffer. And that way we might feel a bit better.
Carolyn, it's so good to be talking about this book. We are talking about No Regrets, a new biography of Edith Piaf by Carolyn Burke. But we're going to be joined in the studio in just a moment to continue our discussion with Nadine Garner, who, of course, is a very favourite actress of many, many people. And I'm looking forward very much to meeting her.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Nadine Garner has joined us in the studio.
Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
I'm in such auspicious company. I feel so privileged to be here.
We're all ladies.
It's a bit of a hard act to follow, though. I think Carolyn Burke and Edith Piaf.
You're
in the same league.
I think you're going to be quite all right, Nadine. Of course, everyone will remember Nadine Garner's work over the years as a wonderful actress. You won a Logie for the Henderson Kids.
I did. That was a long time ago.
Still got it?
It's dusty somewhere, but it is in the study somewhere.
She has starred in Neighbours, The Bill, A Country Practice. I could go on and on, but also, of course, Shakespeare.
Yes,
who's your favourite playwright?
I haven't had too much of a stab at the great playwright. I love Chekhov. I've done a bit of Chekhov, and I'd like to do some more. And I'd like to do some more Shakespeare too. I've been sort of in Tellyland for 4 years doing a cop drama. So.
Well, you've obviously been in film land for some time, and you're in here today particularly to talk about the debut of your short film Afterglow, which is premieres at the St Kilda Film Festival, which opens next Tuesday. And Nadine, I saw Afterglow yesterday, and congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
It really was wonderful. I should say, I can't even remember the last time I saw a short film.
It's not something we see often, is it?
But I watched this, and then I enjoyed it so much I ended up watching quite a few more of them that were on the thing I'd been given to watch, and they were all really good. I mean, I was really impressed with the standard.
I watched all of them, but I only watched Nadine's twice.
Yes,
for research, and yes, I did, and I was also gobsmacked by the quality. Maybe just my naivety about
so
film.
Much better
of all of them
than just about any recent film I can think of that I've seen, or certainly television. So, Nadine, I mean, the first thing, is it a 15-minute limit?
It's 13 minutes. Oh, look, every festival, and the thing about short films is that you kind of make them to go to festivals because you don't obviously get a screening at your local Hoyts. You know, it's a kind of boutique way of filmmaking, I suppose. Ours ended up being 13 minutes. I don't know what the cutoff point is. It can be 50 minutes in some festivals.
Okay.
For the St Kilda Film Festival, I'm not sure what it is, but we come in the category anyway.
Well, I'll let you in a moment tell us what it's about, because I don't want to give away too much. And it's incredible that in 15 minutes, but what I wanted to say is that when I, within the first minute of watching these two characters, an older man and a younger woman, sit down in a little restaurant, what struck me was how much I felt I knew about them in so short a time.
That's great. I guess I wrote the film because I feel instinctively it's now my job to move into storytelling instead of just being an actor employed to tell other people's stories. So I thought, okay, I need to do something that's doable. And what can I do as a director? Well, I know I can facilitate performance. And if I get great actors, that's 90% of the job done. So I had done 4 years of television. I had a wonderful crew and a great relationship with the crew that I was working with. And I pilfered and plundered all of them and asked them to come on board and wrote something quite quickly, actually. I just sort of opened my head and heart and said, okay, what do I need to write that's going to be manageable and doable?
So it wasn't a story you'd...
No.
Give us the bare bones of the story.
The story is a man of some standing in his early 50s, set in 1947 in Victoria somewhere, we don't know where, has fallen in love and had an affair with his housemaid, housekeeper, and she's fallen pregnant, and he's paid for her to terminate the pregnancy and to keep it quiet. And she comes to meet with him, and he's presuming that she's had the procedure and that she's there to tell him everything's fine and clear and he can get on with his life. And in fact, she comes along and says, I'm not terminating. I'm going to go abroad and raise this child by myself. And so we witness a moment in time where the man, who's obviously still in love with her and cares for her, has to make a decision to let her go or stay or go with her. And I was interested in exploring those notions in life, which are head versus heart, and how we commit to our responsibilities and our duties in life, and when we split with those duties and do something irrational and go with an inspiration or an aberration. And in my story, he doesn't go with her. He leaves her and she walks off into the dark night and he never sees her again. And he stays in his comfortable life, and we sort of see him at the end as a sort of broken man who's lost the chance to father the child with a woman he loved. But we also know he's lived a safe and comfortable life. So I wanted to posit those questions in an audience's mind. How, as human beings, do we make those choices? And when do we make the radical choices? And it's interesting to chart anyone's life to see when they play safe and when they play with fire, and how we make
those
decisions.
Well, it's going back to the same theme. I quoted Helen Keller about, you know, security being an illusion.
Well, it is an illusion.
It is an illusion. Mm-hmm. And I watched the film and I thought, because in many ways it's an old story. It's very biblical. It's unrequited love. It's pain. It's head and heart. And
that's right.
But in each case, there's something a little different that comes to it, and it has to be from the author. So there must be something that comes of you in that, and I don't want to give away, you know, the ending. But I found it, you know, it's always interesting when you take an archetypal story of between head and heart.
Yes.
And then, because all stories have an archetype, you know, there's some myth in all of them.
That's true.
Whether it's Sleeping Beauty, whether it wasn't, you know, whatever. So there, it's interesting what happens here, and he makes all these choices. But the other question I have to ask is why in that period? It's a period piece.
Mm.
Why did you make it? Why not modern? You could do the same thing in the 21st century.
I have to say, I really lament the loss of period filmmaking in Australia.
Okay.
I find that the films that stay with me, Australian films, come from the 70s and 80s when we had 10BA tax, you know, breaks for people who... Yeah. And there were well-funded films made, and we had big, grand narratives and crowd scenes and period cinema, you know, which
it's
is a beautiful
done.
Universal.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
So
it's gorgeous.
Beautiful. It looks great.
We don't make period films now because we don't have the money.
Although I was going to say, I thought the when it was set gave it an added drama, of course, about this story, because that particular story unfolding in 1947 is different to it unfolding now.
And
and the other thing about it being period, unconsciously, I think, that people probably wouldn't necessarily see it, but it comes through, and whether you were aware of this or not, in the 21st century, there's a lot of psychotherapy. There's a lot of, you know, understanding of how relationships work, and everybody's got an opinion, and we all read, you know, how to deal with your relationship in 20 ways, we were saying earlier. what I found really interesting about this, that there was no judgment in that piece. You made no judgment, whether you were conscious of that or not. You do not feel either anger or a sense of judgment for his wife, for him, or for her. You just accept it as a story, as a narrative. Whereas often it's you can't help, if you're writing something, to have a judgment.
Yes.
There's no anger. There's no sympathy. There's no. Do you know what I mean? It's just, here is this story, and I think it's partly because it is a short piece.
Yeah.
There's no psychobabble going on there. You haven't delivered that. And as Sally said, from the beginning, you feel that intimacy between them and the sense of, you know, loss.
Yeah.
And then with the, when the wife comes in, you know, we want to kind of hate her, but we don't.
You can imagine a whole wrong. You can imagine a whole backstory as well, though. Carolyn, can you imagine telling Edith Piaf's story in 15 minutes or less?
Exactly. No, I couldn't. No.
But two songs.
She could probably sing it in 15
minutes. That's right.
But as we speak about what Nadine has done, and now I want to see your film, I'm reminded that when I write, I try to write without judgment and psychobabble also. Yeah. I don't feel that those are appropriate, although many people want both things, but I try to resist exactly that. And it sounds as if you have done the same.
I think because I had love and empathy for all the characters, and I felt that as viewers we were going to feel that we were either one or other of the characters, that we were all of them or none of them or one of them, but that we could see ourselves or have lived through or will live through at least one of those characters, you know,
but also,
at some point.
I would hazard a guess that it's precisely because you are fundamentally an actor that's happened as well. Because I've done stand-up for 25 years, but last year I wrote a show that's drama, theatre, actoring, and was working in a theatre drama piece. And one of the things that was profoundly different between... People think, oh, if you're a stand-up, you can act. It's two different things. Yeah. But one of the incredible skills about an actor is that you bring the audience to you and you don't make a judgment. You don't actually... impose on the audience how they should feel, is what I'm trying to say. It's up to them to make that decision. Stand-up, on the other hand, is I'm pushing all the time. I manipulate and commandeer the audience so that they will laugh at a certain point. I'm in control. As an actor, you're not. They have to come to you. See, that's I found that very difficult. I wonder whether unconsciously you did that. So there's no judgment because you just delivered the characters. Here you are, you enjoy the story, and you find yourself in any one of them or all of them.
That's true.
I think that's an amazing skill.
Well, hopefully it resonates with some people. I don't know how.
No, heaps of people.
I don't know how men feel about it. I know women will like it. I don't know. Maybe it's a chick flick.
No, I've watched it with my boyfriend and he loved it too.
Did he like it?
He loved it. Absolutely loved it. And in fact, it's the character, there's a character of a waiter, of course.
My dear friend, Damien Richardson.
It's a great performance.
Yeah, great
actually.
Performance.
And I mean, I was sort of thinking about his character. He's the waiter in this little drama.
Yes. He's the observer. He's us
the
in
witness.
A way. Yeah,
he's the witness. And a very male response, actually. I think there's heaps in it for men, and not forgetting the incredible cars you managed
Nicholas
to
Bell and
get
Mitchell.
Your hands
yes.
on for the
I
for
know.
The beautiful.
Yes.
Oh, no.
Brilliant. I was very lucky. I asked them and they said yes, so I was so thrilled.
<Brilliant.
laughs> Tell us what else was, you know, about making this short film, being on the other side of the camera, of course, for the first time.
It was like
that?
A relief. Oh, it was so nice not to have to be in makeup at 6 o'clock and just turn up and hide behind the camera. And I guess it's one of the greatest indulgences you have as an artist is to have something written and then watch it unfold before you.
It sounds like it all went pretty well.
It went really
not
well.
Not like some film sets I've heard about. Yeah.
It went really well because I had an incredibly accomplished team of crew members with me.
How long did it take? How
it only took it? 2 days. I only had 2 days because
incredible.
I couldn't pay anybody and I was just paying costs. And so
was it filmed in an actual restaurant?
It was shot in Kyneton in Piper Street. In
really?
The Royal George Hotel.
Yeah. So beautiful.
It's very hard to find a period room
yeah.
in Melbourne that doesn't cost a fortune
yep.
and that you can point the camera in various directions and not get some ugly air conditioning system or something that's totally unsightly. So it was a room that felt authentic, and with a little bit of jiggery pokery, we managed to be able to point the camera in three directions, and it still looked quite okay. We had some beautiful production design too from Colin Robinson.
The lighting, the costumes.
The costumes, yeah. Everything was just beautiful.
And my darling husband, Cameron Barnett, was the DOP.
He was. So, I did notice that.
Yeah. And we decided to shoot it on 35mm, which is very old school these days because everything's digital these days. But we thought, no, we want a really filmic period look.
Right.
So we really bit the bullet and spent a lot of money on buying real celluloid.
I'm no film expert, but I think maybe that's what I was picking up in it.
Yeah, every element forms part of the whole, I imagine.
That's right.
How much of the process did you... I mean, you know, people say, oh, I want to direct, you know. There's that joke about Mother Teresa going to heaven, God saying, what do you want? So I want to direct. That's so true. But it doesn't mean you actually can. How much of the actual process, the technical stuff, did you actually understand or have an inkling of?
I pretty much knew how I wanted it to look.
Okay.
Yeah, I knew that
but
it was...
But how to make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I guess because I've worked with camera for a long time. Right. I mean, lens sizes and things like that, I still have to kind of review as I go. I can't go, I need an 80mm lens, let's swing it, because we're on, you know, 15mm. I need to still look through the camera.
Yes.
But
you know,
I get
the language.
I know what I want. I want to see. Yeah, and I know if I want to move the camera or have it on a track. And because we had such a tight time frame, I had a first AD saying, where's your shot list? Where's your shot list?
Well,
and so we basically had to have the shot list worked out already. So we shot what was on the shot list. And then when we got there, we went, oh, let's try and grab a, you know, a little shot of the wine falling over or whatever. But there's always things you don't have time to get. So you hope when you get into the edit that you've got enough material to tell the story.
Yes.
Because the director always wants more coverage.
Of course.
Because that's what we want.
Would you like to make a feature film now? Or are you sort of addicted
Yes, can I
to...
sell? Yeah. Got any spare cash? And so begins the long life process of trying to raise funds in this country to make films.
Is that even harder, I suppose, than being an actor? And
it
probably doesn't apply to you. You've always been in work, but
even incredibly auspicious directors like Fred Skepsy find it very hard to come back to Australia and get a film up. I mean, it's just not something we seem to value as a culture.
Do you have a film in your mind? I can't believe how quickly you said this story. I do.
I have a few. Some are enormous and would require, you know, international travel and investment from Spain and France and big stories.
Well, if you're
going to
do it, you want to make sure you get international travel and investment.
That'd be good, wouldn't it?
To go to all that work and just stay in Kyneton, as beautiful as Kyneton is.
Kyneton is beautiful. But, yes, there are big stories and there are smaller stories. I've got a feeling the smaller stories are going to get funding first, but I think I'm probably going to spend a large part of the rest of my life trying to write them and make them.
What sort of this? It's probably not the best time in your career to be asking you this, given that you're seeking funding. But you know, what sort of shape do you think the Australian film industry is in right now?
I think it's in the doldrums, Sally. Yeah, I think TV is having a real purple patch, and I think people are very happy to tune in and watch their own culture on television.
Similar in America, isn't it? The best sort of like The Wire.
Great TV. We're in a period of great television. In cinema in Australia, we're a little bit at sea. I don't quite know what stories we want to tell or what stories we want to watch. We're not going to watch our own films. So there's something amiss with the stories we're telling. I think that's just cyclical. Maybe it's going to come round in time. There's breakthrough films, obviously, like Animal Kingdom that strike a chord internationally. But it's just a time of cyclical.
Really? I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether it's not sort of more cultural. And in fact,
we love football.
We don't have a narrative in a lot of ways in our culture at the moment that it's connected to that maybe. And you know, we've already made the Gallipoli movie. We've already, you know, the kind of obvious ones have perhaps been done, and we don't have a deeper layer to kind of move to.
Or maybe like everything else, it's, you know, more demographic, you know, so there are some films that some people are going to go to and others will go to other films rather than just big blockbusters that come along. I mean, maybe it's just that whenever there's a time of transition and things are shifting, then something will sprout up somewhere.
Yeah.
But people like you have got to keep doing what you're doing because you've got that background
and
you've got an idea. And I love the Woody Allen way of shooting, just shooting in Manhattan. I mean, you could keep going Kyneton. Go to Flinders Lane.
That's true.
You know, we have some of the best lanes ever.
Oh, Melbourne's a beautiful city to film in. It's divine.
Exactly.
Carolyn, can I ask you, obviously Edith Piaf, you know, the biopic that was made, was it last year?
Oh, it was about 3 years ago.
You're quite generous in the book, you know, that it's a, I think, you know, describe it as quite beautiful, beautifully shot and so on. But how frustrating is it as a biographer when something is captured forever on film and you know it's wrong, you know, or you just, that it's not right. Yeah.
Very frustrating at first, but you know you've got to live with it and you've got to find a way to show other sides that will give a fuller, richer picture of your subject. Because my first reaction when I saw the film was, well, I think I'll go jump off the bridge. Right, yeah. It was so depressing and so reductive. So then I had to sort
of think. I
think
it was the photography, the actual look of it you might have mentioned,
yes,
was nice,
but,
yeah.
The next day, trying to follow in Piaf's footsteps and be resilient about it, I said to myself, well, all right, now you know what you've got to do. You've got to tell all the rest of the story. You've got to reframe the narrative. You've got to bring out her joie de vivre, her generosity, her gaiety, her laughter, her resilience, the things that were lacking from the film. So it wasn't so bad after all. But I do have to explain to people frequently that this is not the whole story that
yes,
you see.
You can feel that frustration, you know, although I think it's great to have a film and a book to be able to, as well as, of course, the records. Which
I think we could have another Piaf film. There's room for it. We could have Piaf at War, for example. Any number of stories
who
are still
cast?
Possible. Ah, who would I cast? Perhaps... Gilles Legros, who goes around performing all around Europe and the US and elsewhere as the voice of Edith Piaf.
Oh,
and
was
very good.
If she looked like her.
She looks like her.
And don't miss Nadine Garner's film Afterglow at the St Kilda Film Festival. It really is terrific. And Carolyn Burke, congratulations. No Regrets.
Thank you.
Biography of Edith Piaf. We get to, you know, enjoy her music, and now we can know a little bit more about her very, very interesting life. So thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
And Rachel Berger, it has been absolutely delightful.
No, you were
delightful.
Fabulous. I was rubbish. You were great.
I've had a ball. All wonderful.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.